Hi, my name is Chris, a postdoc and associated member of ML4Q, and you're listening to ML4Q&A, a show where members from the Matter and Light for Quantum Computing cluster answer questions about their work, their research, and the future of quantum. In today's episode, I'm talking to Glaucia Murta, an ML4Q young investigator in Düsseldorf. We will talk about Glaucia's passion for fundamental questions, device independence, and a great outreach project, the podcast OK Quantico, she just launched in her home country, Brazil. The link to it will be in the show notes. It's in Portuguese, but there will be English transcripts, so check it out. Glaucia Murta, it is my pleasure to welcome you to the ML4Q and A podcast.
Thanks for inviting me.
No, it's a special pleasure. I mean, we met when we both worked at QTech.
Right.
And accordingly, we have, went to a lot of parties together, I guess, because there's PhD parties every month, roughly.
Even though I was not a PhD anymore, but yes.
I was a PhD student, yes. So it was a good time to socialize and meet the other groups, definitely. So now you are working in Düsseldorf, and so part of an associated member of ML4Q, and you work on very abstract ways to engage with quantum mechanics to do communication tasks, but also to show bounds on what can be achieved with quantum mechanics. Is that the right way to characterize it?
Yes, maybe bounds, but or trying to understand a bit more the fundamentals of quantum mechanics. Maybe you can say with an information theoretic perspective. So that's why it goes into these tasks and games.
Yeah.
But at the same time, also, while we don't understand it, how can we use it already for some interesting tasks?
So how did you get interested in quantum mechanics?
Maybe I can tell like what happened during my, let's say, during my career, because
yes.
I don't know if it's like this for you, but when I entered physics, it seemed to me like everyone wanted to study cosmology, the origin of the universe and things like that. But then you don't always have professors working on these things, and you have to pick a topic for your bachelor. So actually, first I went for experimental physics. I was in Raman spectroscopy. But then I was like, no, I like really fundamental things. And then I went for quantum field theory, which is like, okay, now I finally get to study something very fundamental. But somehow, maybe I didn't fit well with my supervisors or the topic. To me, it was like, I'm looking at these calculations, and at some point you got lost of what is happening. And for me, I really like to be on control of understanding everything that I'm talking about as much as possible, let's say. And in this, like, quantum information fits very well, because I'm in the abstract level, I'm talking about a qubit, so I removed all the real life problems that are happening that makes it difficult. So like I like more to work with first principle things. And then at some point I got in touch with the person who became my supervisor in the master's and PhD. It's Marcelo Terra Cunha, and he worked with contextuality, non-locality, and also a bit of cryptography. I was already started with that. And then I really liked, so it fit very well, because I was very frustrated of studying this quantum field theory book, where I was not able to understand which calculation I was doing. And then on the other hand, I went to this other field, which has many fundamental open questions, but for me, I can visualize, I'm in control of which elements I'm adding.
Yeah, I can totally understand that. I completely agree that, I mean, I also had both in my master's, quantum field theory and sort of quantum information. And like for me, definitely, I prefer the sort of just doing some matrix math to doing the abstract integral stuff mm-hmm. in quantum field theory. And indeed, with quantum field theory, sometimes you really don't know if, I mean, there's all these problems of if things converge and so on. And I guess
As long as you have a, you know, closed finite sized quantum system,
everything will converge
and yes. there's no craziness. So in the end, it's multiplying matrices and you can get the results, right?
Yeah, but we've a lot of interesting fundamental questions. So that's why, for me, it was much more comfortable to work on this field.
No, that's very understandable. So it sort of was the right degree of abstraction and mathematics and axiomatic reasoning. No, that's very nice. You did your studies in Belo Horizonte, right? In Brazil.
Yeah.
Which some of the people might know from the World Cup, I guess, mostly.
Yes.
At least that's the only time I heard heard the name. Although it's a pretty big state in Brazil, and
Belo Horizonte is the capital of the state.
Of the state, Minas.
Yes, yeah. And many people come from there, including Fernando Brandão.
Yeah. So I did want to maybe ask an early question. So you're from Brazil and studied there. But a lot of the initial developments of quantum mechanics and all the famous people are essentially old white men from North America and Europe, right? How do you feel about this? And do you feel that this is like changing in a positive way?
One thing that I should separate, so I can tell a bit about Brazil, but I actually have not traveled in South America, so I cannot tell about the situation on the other countries. Even though in my university at some point was a place where we would receive a lot of students from other places in South America. But I would say at least, and again, I can tell a bit more on quantum information theory side, that when I was a student, my impression, we were quite a reference in the sense that there was a few universities, there was in some research in Rio de Janeiro, São Paulo, also Belo Horizonte, with many researchers that were quite active. I would say starts like 30 years. So I would say it's quite established. But of course, as you said, it's not the contributions that we associate in the beginning of quantum mechanics. But my country is very complicated. especially now, having been like many years in Europe, I can clearly see the difference of incentivizing research and the opportunities that we have. So I was telling you before that, for example, still the PhD in Brazil is like a scholarship. It's not a job with a contract like in Germany. So this means that people don't have social security. And if they don't manage to finish the PhD within the 4 years, they are just left without the scholarship and they have to work for free. So like the importance that even a postdoc researcher is a scholarship, it's not a contract, by the way. So the importance and the investments that are given for research is completely different level at the moment. So this makes it a bit impossible to keep up with the same level. You asked if it's improving, and then I can give the example of Brazil. That's, for example, when I was at master's PhD, I got a very fruitful time that I had the opportunity to go abroad with a Brazilian scholarship during my PhD. And then, 4 years ago, the country was completely in a difficult time, especially for academia, and some universities were in the imminence of being closed because there was no fundings to pay basic bills. Now we are in a fruitful time again, that at least there will be some investments in education. So it fluctuates. So it's also hard to see to say an improvement. We lost some researchers in Brazil that decided to go abroad. They were quite established. They had a group there already, but decided to go abroad because of the situation. So
it's not always just upwards. It's not always just,
yes, exactly. So I think some things stay, some things that we achieve, they stay, but it's also very sensitive to the economical and political situation. While here, I have the impression like, it's so established, the world is on fire, but the academia will more survive, or less stay untouched.
I mean, certainly also Germany will have budget cuts because after Corona and our current slow burning, maybe financial crisis, maybe not, no one knows. I mean, eventually these budget problems arrive at the level of academia, but they arrive with some delay, I guess, because a lot of the programs are decided years ahead.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know. It's hard to say how the funding will look. I mean, for our field, it's also always a really interesting question. I'm always wondering how long will people stay and fund quantum computing based on promises, and when will quantum computing be funded based on results that deliver like real economic benefits? Also,
This is an interesting point, like compared to South America, because I was looking up some time ago, because in Europe we have the flagship, US has a lot of money. And in Brazil, for example, only this year it was announced some amount of money
dedicated
for quantum technology, and also to bring not only inside academia, but connect also to the maybe companies that are interested. So there was some initiative already some time ago. Once a Brazilian federation was visiting us here in Cologne, and they already had this initiative, but there was no money associated from the government.
Yeah.
And now this year it was announced. And the headline of the news was the only South American initiative with money. So I would have to check that, but at least the headlines on the news that I read, then it seems to me that there is no other money investment substantially happening in other countries.
Well, indeed, in Europe, probably the quantum technology investment is in the flagship alone is 8-9 billion, right? And the US and Chinese programs, I think, are bigger. The funding landscape definitely works differently. And I mean, I think indeed we should always maybe remember that we are quite privileged in Germany to have even though maybe as a PhD student who earns 1,500 euros a month doesn't always feel privileged, but indeed it's very nice to earn a steady salary and to get unemployment benefits even if things go badly. Mm-hmm. So we already mentioned a little bit now that you went abroad, you did sort of a sandwich PhD. Can you explain how this works?
Well, so this was the name of this Brazilian program. Sandwich maybe refers to I start in Brazil, I go sometime abroad, and then I come back to Brazil. So it's like a sandwich. I don't know. Mm-hmm. So this to me looks very much like here you have the Erasmus program, and then I could choose where I would go, and then at the time I could spend up to 1 year abroad. And then I chose that I wanted to go to Poland. Well, actually, I wanted to go to the Horodecki group, and then I looked, where are they? In Poland. At the time, where is Poland? Okay, I see. And then I went there. And it was very nice, yeah.
So you went to Gdansk, which is, I mean, indeed, it's not the first thing that people would think when visiting Europe. But indeed, the Horodecki family is quite prolific, especially in this topic of abstract quantum mechanics. Right. Let's
say. That's a good.
I don't know what's the right way to.
Yeah. So during my master's, Fernando Brandão, he was a professor at my university for some time, and then I was lucky that I was at the same time, and then he gave a course on quantum information, and the course was like very advanced, so we wouldn't have a book, but we would read papers and discuss. And many of the papers, many of the results were from this. I was seeing this Horodecki all the time, and I really enjoyed reading their papers. So So then when I was in the PhD, and it was the time that I was completely decided that I wanted to do this 1 year abroad. So there we would have to write a project or something. And then I told my supervisor, like, I think I would like to go to this, the place where the Horodetskys are. And then he was very supportive. Very nice. Then you should talk to Fernando, because he knew them. And then he told me, very nice. Maybe you should contact this Horodetsky specifically, which was Michał Horodetsky. And then I contacted them, and then they were also very happy to have me there at the time. And so as you say, there was not so many international students. I remember I had a colleague, he was doing his PhD there. He was Indian, and then he was having a huge problem that the students didn't want the courses to be in English. So it was the time, this was how many years ago? Like 10 years, 8 years ago, like some years ago. And now the institute, like, super international, there is a lot of, but at the time I went there, there was not many international students. And they were surprised that there was a student who wanted to come with everything paid, and they didn't have to worry about money with me. Yeah.
And I mean, also, Polish is probably among difficult languages, like in the more difficult languages one could try to learn, I think. At least that's what people say. I've never.
Yeah, I mean, now comparing to German, technically it's more difficult. There is more grammar problems, but I would say didn't make much difference.
Yeah. But I guess indeed you mostly spoke English, and what there, right?
Yes. So I tried to learn the language a bit, but while here in Germany, people usually don't speak English in the street. I don't know if you know that, but that's a fact. In Poland, it was even worse. So there was no chance that, or even like the secretariat at the institute, sometimes they wouldn't speak English. So yes,
you had to learn a little bit.
And also my English was also not very good, by the way, because it was my first time abroad, so I did not have the experience of speaking English.
So then what did you work on at that time? What was the project of your research day there?
So when I arrived, I already had a project with my supervisor in Brazil, and then I continued working on that. But then with them, I interacted mostly with some postdocs there. So I worked a bit with Martin Pawłowski on randomness. And it's interesting because in the end, this didn't turn into any publication. But afterwards in Delft, I was working in cryptography, and there was randomness all the time. So it was good to get in touch with this concept. Randomness amplification at the time was the project. And then the person I worked the most with was Ravi Ramanathan. And he was also a postdoc at the time. And then we started working in these non-local games, which then... So it's a game, so it's easy to explain. There is Alice and Bob. Each of them want to achieve, they want to win some specific task. But then in the context of these works were also related to, fundamental principles of quantum mechanics, or how can we bound how much the quantum mechanics can win these games. So I really liked, and because also in these works I could use a lot of techniques that are quite often used in non-locality works, some numerics as well.
So just to make more clear, the idea is that you have a game, Alice and Bob need to perform a task, and you compare if you give them entangled qubits or if you don't give them entangled qubits, how will they do?
Yes. So if they would be only classical, that would be the non-entangled qubits. But it's interesting here that we don't really talk about quantum mechanics in this scenario so much specifically. So this is what we call device independent, because We don't model specifically. I don't know. I don't say that I have a photon, that I have a qubit, or that I have a Q-trait. I just say I have this system. I have questions and I have answers. And then very abstractly, I say these answers, they were like predetermined by Alice and Bob. So they talked before and they decided on a strategy. So this is classical. So not necessarily it's a classical system, but they could talk and agree on a strategy.
So each of them can have a sheet of paper and say,
yes, exactly.
If you say this, if they ask this, I say that.
So they decide what they will answer depending on the question that they receive. And then they go far apart and now they are going to receive the questions. So anything that could be discussed before and, as you said, written on a sheet of paper is classical.
It's like this game with newlyweds, right? Where you ask them questions and you see if they give the same answer to see if they are truly
in love.
Meant for each other.
Exactly.
So they, Alice and Bob have to win at this game?
Yes. And then, but maybe there, usually it's a game that there would be some inconsistency. So it's not possible that they win all the time with some agreed strategy like that. And now we say, okay, now instead of using this sheet of paper, they have some quantum systems, they make a measurement, and depending on the result of this measurement, they give their answer according to the result of this measurement. So they could only agree of like, if I have this question, I will make this specific measurement or so on. In this scenario, we can even talk about theories that goes beyond quantum mechanics. So I will have this mechanism of giving answers which satisfies some mathematical properties, and then I want to see what is my probability of winning. Mm-hmm. And then in this scenario, it's very interesting that if I'm restricted to classical physics, I have some probability of winning. If I'm restricted to quantum mechanics, I can beat this probability of winning and win with higher probability. And if I have something that's even more general than quantum mechanics, I can win with even higher probability.
Yeah. So the quantum resource, in a way, like if we were playing a game with a quantum resource, in a sense, it's like if we had each a coin with us, right? And we flip it and we don't know if it will be heads or tails, but we will always both get heads or both get tails like that. Well, it's almost, that's still kind of a classical.
That's still kind of classical.
Because, yeah, let's try to make clear to people what is the difference between the classical coin that gives the same result and the quantum bits.
To me, but there's no classical analogy, but I would say it's not just a coin, but there is some other feature of the coin.
Because you can measure in different ways.
Because I need to be able to look at incompatible measurements. Otherwise, there will be nothing that is non-classical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's unfortunately, it's really quite difficult to explain to without like using physics and mathematics and saying this is what a qubit is. Indeed, in a sense, this analogy of the coin gets to some point, but the problem is that the qubits can be measured in different ways. Or is this already too physical? Like I think in your picture, you would still say it's important that you can measure the qubit in different ways.
Yes, or in like mathematical terms, it should be incompatible measurements.
Which means that you and I, if we play the game, we can, in addition to, like, we can take a decision on how we measure our qubit.
Yes.
And the problem is, depending on if we measure it the same or if we measure it differently, we either get correlations or no correlations, right? Is that a good way to put it? Like if we choose to measure our qubit in the same basis, let's say for a given situation, we can get perfect correlations.
Mm-hmm.
And if we measure in different bases, well, you get a random outcome, I get a random outcome. And
a random, yes, but you can also get it doesn't have to be on the extreme, can be something in between where get some correlation. Because, for example, for the simplest game, it's actually this something in between. It's not the extremes.
Yeah.
So I somehow get a little bit of correlation in everything. So they are not always the same answers or the different answers, but more towards the same answer.
The fundamental thing here that we're talking about is entanglement and as a quantum resource. And you can use the games to explore this.
Actually, it's non-locality because we have a problem entanglement is necessary, but it's not sufficient.
Yes.
So it's a resource
beyond
entanglement. Let's say.
And the underlying understanding of a lot of this came from the early understanding of this was really Bell's inequalities, right? That sort of early on, Einstein and collaborators discovered that entanglement is tricky and difficult, but then for a while they sort of just concluded that this is why quantum mechanics must be wrong. But it turned out that was not right. But then indeed, Bell discovered that it's actually deeper than just quantum mechanics and started this whole field of non-locality. Is that in a way what happened?
Well, now it's a historical question. But I think somehow Einstein was a bit unhappy with this... randomness that you couldn't predetermine some results. So that's what the paper that they bring up comes from. Like, can we actually, maybe this randomness that we observe, it's just our lack of a lack of knowledge of the complete picture. So could we complete quantum mechanics so that we would get rid of this... this randomness, and then we could say, actually, the result was predetermined. I just didn't know this other variable, which would help me to know this result. I mean, in classical, we cannot predict the weather because we don't know all the variables. The more variables we would know, we could predict the weather better the next day. So, like, it's not something fundamentally impossible to predict. But in quantum mechanics, the mathematical formalism was saying that it is impossible to predict. So then this EPR paper came to question this. So what's the problem? Can quantum mechanics, should it be completed, or what is missing? Then to say that immediately there is Bell, so yes, so Bell paper, not immediately, like 20, years 30 years later. And then people did nothing in the meantime. So I would say that supposedly there was many people more into philosophy discussing what's the problem quantum mechanics.
And you have the entire Bohm quantum mechanics.
Being developed at the same time.
In the meantime, there was a whole effort to come up with a way to actually fix. I mean, it's not like people ignored the Einstein result and didn't do anything for 20 years. There was intense effort to fix
it. Von Neumann showing impossibility of a hidden variable model, and afterwards, and then comes the paper of Bell, which turns this maybe question of the EPR into something that is very well mathematically written. And afterwards, then we have Clauser, Horn, Schmoni, and Holt, and some works of Clauser more showing that, okay, actually we can even do an experiment and ask this question experimentally, not only theoretically anymore. Because, this is very borderline with philosophy, interpretation of quantum mechanics, and this is something that maybe goes a bit too far from physics. And then what Bell does to me, and then also Clauser, is to bring this back to physics. So look, I have a very simple mathematical statement, and I can even propose an experiment which can test this question. So then we get these things back into physics, I would say. But of course, so it gets back into physics, such that us who likes applications and likes to discuss, to enjoy the abstract formalism of quantum mechanics, we can work with it without us being philosophers and still worry about these things. But of course, there are still many open questions in interpretation of quantum mechanics and people coming up with different interpretations. And this continues a very live field and so on. But... we bring it close to us. And afterwards, so maybe just to say that, so Bell made like a very clear three hypotheses, like I have that the results of my experiment, they are predetermined by some variable that I don't know. We need to have locality that, let's say, there is no communication faster than the speed of light. And we need to have independence of the measurements, like the measurements of Alice and Bob, they should be chosen independently. So, and if we have these three hypotheses, we know that then we can go back to the game. The probability of winning this game is a certain value. I will give the example of 3/4, so 75% probability. It's not a random number, though. I'm not talking which classical system I have. I'm not talking that I have a coin or anything. I'm just talking about the simple hypothesis. And then this bounds this probability to 75%. But then we do an experiment where we choose the questions randomly, but then for each of these questions, we do an experiment with a quantum system, and depending on the outcome, I give you the answer, and then you win this game with 85% probability. So well, that's very, very interesting. So this is what Bell did, and then... now, like, we have a framework to ask these questions. What happens when I have this hypothesis of local realism? That was how it was called, these three hypotheses together. And then you can make many different expressions, not only the ones that were in the first Bell's paper or CHSH paper, but you can make different questions such that different quantum systems will give you an advantage over this question. It's still like we are in the abstract side, like, oh, interesting, quantum theory violates this hypothesis. So this is fundamentally like astonishing. And I don't know how to explain what does it mean exactly to violate this hypothesis. I just know it violates. But then some more years later, so Arthur Eckert in 91, then Eckert did this cryptographic protocol, which was exactly exploring this non-locality. And some years later, it consolidated this field of device-independent cryptography. So now we have this very interesting application that we can do unconditionally secure quantum communication, let's say, where we don't even need to talk about the details of the experiment. I don't need to know. I just need to use to explore this non-locality feature of quantum mechanics.
And you can indeed, in a sense, by phrasing it as these games and by putting clear probabilities, what you were saying is like every time before I use my crypto system, I can, you know, play this game with my crypto system, if you will. And if I win a certain amount of the time, then I can say, okay, there's no way for somebody who has tried to break into my crypto system. Like, essentially, if I reach a certain probability of success, I know that my crypto system is secure, independent of actually how it works in detail.
Mm-hmm. Because if there was a variable that would determine what are the outcomes of my crypto system, then I would be within the 75%. So if I'm violating, it means this variable doesn't exist. So this is, let's say, qualitatively, we need to make it quantitative. And for that, we really explore the structure of quantum mechanics and what is the power that the adversary could have. But qualitatively, we are just saying, okay, then this variable doesn't exist. So no one can have access to it. In particular, the eavesdropper cannot have access to it. And that's where the security is coming from.
And what are the ways to win 100% of the time? What are the scenarios that can actually beat quantum mechanics? That's the sort of, you have to already know what will happen scenario. Like,
So just by the way, that depends on this game specifically that I'm talking about, 75%, 85%. And yes, there is some more general theories which would win with 100% of the time. So it's interesting because this type of theory, they also do not violate, let's say, communication. So there is not signaling between. If I signal, if Alice tells Bob, this is my input, then they can win. So if there is some signaling, they can win. But there is some theories which I impose, there is no signaling. So they cannot signal to each other. They need to have probability distribution. So it's in this abstract level, the same way that Bell had this abstract level for classical theory, saying I have a predetermined outcome. Now I would just say that I have non-signaling distributions. And this is, I'm talking about my object is a probability distribution. It is non-signaling. And then it gives you one. The problem is that we have for interpretation, not problem, but something interesting, is that we are talking this very abstract level where my elements are these statistics of inputs and outputs. Mm-hmm. And I just say that this statistics has some properties. So either I can say that there is some variable that gives predetermined values, or I can say that this statistics is generated by measurements in a quantum system. Or I say that, for example, it is some probability distribution that is non-signaling. So I didn't put anything in here that is like a physical principle. So then this is just math. Yeah. And the elements of my system is this vector of probability distribution. But then there is a field of research that then tries to maybe axiomatize what are the properties of these probability distributions, trying to find some physical principle. For example, there is a nice paper by Wim van Dam that shows if I would have these things that wins with probability 1, they are called PR boxes from Popescu and Horlish, because they showed in a paper that if you just have this non-signaling, you still can win with probability 1. If you have that, you could actually compute any function of two parties with just one bit of information. So any classical, so it would trivialize communication complexity. So maybe if you say, then you start finding some information theoretical principles, I would say, I don't know what explains this 85% of quantum mechanics. I will say that a physical theory should not trivialize communication complexity. So I rule out these PR boxes.
So it should not be like if you have a function and the function depends on something that I do and something that you do, but we don't know. Like we each get only part of the input, obviously, and we cannot tell each other what we got.
Yeah,
you're basically saying that I mean, this is similar to the game, right? We get a question, which is the input, and you are saying that the types of resources that we would have in order to win the game would also mean that we could compute any of those, like any such function. Without communicating with each other.
With communicating one bit.
With communicating only one bit, even though
the input
and
has
output
an input,
that we have to give is very big. I mean, it sounds like it is a much better idea for us to do more research into building a PR box than into these qubit things, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, let's say it another way. Like, if you could actually build a PR box, that would be quite valuable, because any distributed computation that you would have to do
yes, but then probably, but then the world would maybe not be so interesting as
indeed.
Well.
So we believe that basically we believe that it,
no PR box not possible.
Exist.
Yeah, but there is many in between possible sets.
Yeah. So the field of possible probability distributions is very large. Quantum mechanics covers some of it, and they allow you to win in a certain way.
Yeah.
But apparently in such a way that doesn't trivialize all of mathematical problems or...
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, this is also, in a strange way, the problem with quantum computing, right? It seems that quantum computing can solve some problems that classical computers can't, but we don't believe it will solve all problems.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we actually don't believe, like, there's these, I mean, it always sounds somewhat dramatic, right? But what is it? Computational complexity, people say that it will collapse the polynomial hierarchy or things like that. So quantum mechanics somehow is not, like, it's interesting, but it's not bringing everything down somehow.
It's not trivializing
all of computation. Yeah. So in your day-to-day work, you sort of pick a problem like this and you ask yourself, if I have these type of special quantum resources, how well can I do? But what I find particularly nice about device independence as an experimental physicist is you actually give us a number and you say, if you reach this, you succeed. Like, it doesn't matter how, right?
Right.
So, I mean, that in a sense, that's very good news for experimental physicists, because oftentimes we worry about, I don't know, our photon loss rate or our measurement errors or our qubit gate errors or things like that. But in a sense, the bounds that you impose by device independence means that if you can reach this certain number, then all the details don't matter anymore. Like, if you have a task and you say this is the device independent limit and mm-hmm. you can beat it, that's all I have to care about?
Yes, but of course, let's say to reach this number, photon loss is a huge problem, for example.
Yeah.
It's because exactly by the fact that I'm not saying that I have a photon, I cannot be sure that I had a photon loss and that or that instead it was this malicious device, which I don't know what is inside my experiment, that decided, because I chose to do this experiment, it decided, OK, I will say it was a photon loss because it's not the one that will give you the probability of winning the game or so.
Yeah.
So exactly because we are not making assumptions, you cannot be sure, or you cannot assume that you had a photon loss, because photon loss is would be okay in some scenarios, like in cryptography, for example. We have protocols where if you have a photon loss, you just say, okay, we lost the photon, let's redo it again. But in this case, if you lost the photon, you would have to do some strategy, because otherwise it opens up these loopholes, which you might have heard this term, mm-hmm. Which means that I mean, potentially it could have been
somebody who sent a signal.
Who sent a signal, or the device who decided to do something according to what the eavesdrop wanted and not. And so you cannot post-select your experiment. You cannot discard these rounds in order to compute your winning probability. So you basically cannot have photon loss.
So indeed, the experiment needs to be a little bit better. A lot better. let's say, for the non-device independent case. So exactly, let's give an example. So I guess, what are the famous example cases? For example, a key distribution is like the normal thing. So you have that you and I want to come up with the random key, and I think the two-party key distribution is tricky device independently, right? Or is it?
No. So on that, I can say that, let's say, non-device independent, device dependent with characterized devices, we are in like in fibers of orders of hundreds of kilometers and megabytes and satellites. Yeah, so all of this and this means, like, in the, I don't know, the experiments are maybe like generate a reasonable amount. So we had this let's say, cool demonstration where there was a video call between China and Austria that was encrypted with VB84 QKD. So, like, so it has to be some amount of bits that we need to have. On the other hand, for the device independent QKD, we had the first proof of principle demonstrations last year or the year before. now I'm a bit lost in time, but either last year or the year before, proof of principle demonstration. This means that like...
The rate is very low.
Either they didn't even achieve the amount of data to properly do the post-processing and so on, but they just showed that if you would wait long enough, you would achieve, or they have like 200 bits that's at the end of the experiment. So so you see that it was not even possible. When I was in Delft, I wrote this paper, so it was 2016, it was towards device independent, where we were really evaluating what is the level of noise that the experiments are right now and the number of rounds that we would need to have. So at 2016, the experiments were not there yet, so it needed some more years. The problem is that the amount of noise that we can tolerate is exactly where the experiments are right now. So yeah. That's why, of course, in the future, if this somehow gets improved, then there would not be a question and it would be much simpler. As you said, I just do device independent because I don't need to worry about all these details or all these assumptions. And actually, many of these assumptions, it's nice, there are many QKD experiments and there are many hacking experiments, which are really people hacking these crypto systems by exploring the fact that some assumption was not satisfied. While in the IQKD, all of these hacking so far, they wouldn't work because there is no assumption there. So it would be much simpler indeed, but... At the moment, experimentally, it's much more difficult to do the IQKD.
So I guess the only thing that would remain for the evil eavesdropper in case of is to like the only sort of real hack that still remains, or the only attack that eavesdroppers can still do, is they can hack the cable and just shoot a lot of photons into the cable and sort of noise out the communication.
So if she would hack the cable, they would abort the protocol.
Yeah,
so she would make
indeed,
it impossible
they would not,
to...
They would not break into the... Like, they could stop. The only thing that the hacker can still do, like, let's say, is to cut the communication, to make it impossible.
Or hack inside the... Well, because the problem is if we have the assumption of isolated Atlas and Bob.
Yeah.
That's a big assumption. Because if there is some machine inside that is collecting the key and then afterwards we broadcast it outside, that's the problem.
Yeah.
If Alice or Bob are hacked, let's say.
Yes.
But other than that, at the moment, I cannot think of a simple hack other than really leaking information from the labs.
The promise of a device-independent quantum communication is then indeed sort of total security. I mean, at the current time, public key cryptography is also still pretty safe, right?
Yeah.
So if you and I wanted to communicate securely via email over the internet, we are probably capable of doing it at the moment. And I mean, that's the other argument maybe against quantum communication. We currently have a technology that allows secure communication based on this prime number things. And we also already have some mathematical foundation for a secure communication that is even immune to the sort of quantum factorizing algorithm, right? It only means that we have to have better computers, right? Is it clear... eventually quantum communication will become more economical than the computer resources needed for post-quantum cryptography?
Yeah, no, also not clear to me. So it can be that, I think maybe more realistically, the two things would go together until that. So maybe if quantum cryptography is very cheap, then at some point you just start using it because it would be even simpler. But it's also likely that instead it goes together.
Yeah.
Which doesn't, doesn't invalidate that we keep researching on that. First, because of all these fundamental interesting points that we discussed so far.
Exactly.
But also, like, all these developments towards, for example, violation of Bayer inequality, we had the Nobel Prize now, really pushed long-distance quantum communication. And quantum communication in the sense of, like, sending a quantum system through a channel will be necessary for quantum computing or for cloud quantum computing and so on. So maybe not to do QKD, but still these developments will go together. But maybe, yes, maybe quantum crypto will be restricted to really, for example, governmental communications. But I don't have a, a clear feeling of if I would have to guess.
No, me neither. I mean, I think, like, these economical questions to me, like, I mean, it's not obviously neither you nor me can really answer them super productively anyway, because we don't run cell phone companies or like the details of the economics are quite complicated in the end.
And of the users and as of the well, users or and what will be used exactly. for.
so maybe, I mean, I it's always a question that we get asked, because I think some of our funding comes from the hope that there will be economic benefits to this research. But the research is, of course, interesting, independent of a lot of these sort mm-hmm. of, I don't know. I mean, yeah, how is it for you? Do you... is it more like this playful aspect of engaging with quantum mechanics that motivates you, or the sort of really that you could solve, I don't know, safe communication or something like that?
No, for me, I don't see it as I'm solving safe communication. I just find it... interesting to ask, like, what could fundamentally be solved, or so, like, well, safe communication is one thing, but what if I try to do this other task that I have these security guarantees that I want? Can I have it with quantum mechanics or not? And communication, safe communication is one example, but there is many other cryptographic tasks, or like we want to do some secret sharing, or we want to do some more complicated things. And for some of them, we don't have this unconditional security of quantum mechanics, but instead we get an advantage in terms of performance. Again, in this very future where quantum...
Where we all easily share quantum resources.
To me, I find it interesting to put... maybe more as a mathematical question, which features, which security guarantees can I achieve with quantum mechanics?
Is there good examples of multiplayer tasks, for example, where you can classically not solve the task at all, but quantum mechanically you can solve it?
There is one, for example, of anonymous communication. We have a work on that with the cluster, but there we were doing some like intermediate case where we just anonymously distributed a key, but just the anonymous, I want to anonymously send a quantum state. So we are in a network or send classical information or whatever, but we are in a network. And you and me, we want to exchange some information such that the others doesn't know that we are doing that. And then with quantum systems, you have what is called like non-traceable anonymity, that even if at the end of the protocol someone hacks me and look at what was my inputs and outputs in this protocol, my private inputs and outputs, it doesn't have information on my identity. And this is something that classically it's not possible. Then if people would check what is the information you would have, then they could detect it.
So it's something where in the case of whistleblowing or so, where you could eventually maybe construct scenarios where this becomes interesting.
Yes, exactly.
So that you have, I don't know, a company or something, and they gather together and some people want to say something that's wrong and there's other people who want to keep it quiet.
Exactly. And then if they look at your files, they could trace that you were the person who said the information. But in this particular case where we really have this untraceable feature, then we really need to have a perfect pure state. That's why in the cluster we were looking into this task, because I find it quite interesting. But in the task that we look, we have noise, it's an intermediate case, and we don't have this untraceability, for example.
I see.
But such type of features.
Can you bound the traceability? Like if you have a very, very, very good state, can you sort of make it unlikely that somebody can trace you?
On a single time use, maybe, but usually you would repeat the protocol several times, and then this also breaks the problem there. And then you can have things that are just quantum. In this case, I said you are sending a classical message like whistleblower, but I could send you a quantum state such that the others are not. And this, I really need some quantum mechanics. Okay, why you are going to use this quantum state for, I don't know. but just to say that is a task that it's not classical.
So in the end, the sort of game theory phrasing is a very good way to turn a problem into mathematics. But for a lot of these problems, there is sort of real world applications and interesting future task that we currently cannot solve without having trust or honesty as a requirement from the participants.
The game is a good thing to study like non-locality future, but this example I just gave, it's about entanglement feature. So it's not a game scenario, it's a task scenario, like we have a whistleblower, but not necessarily... I would go to the game framework, and I still have some nice tasks that I can do with quantum.
We should shift gears a little bit and talk about. So you are in Düsseldorf for 4 years now, and we had some like. First of all, I should maybe talk a little bit. How do you like Düsseldorf and Germany? Is it?
I like a lot. yeah. It's a very nice city. I think I somewhat found the German society much better for my integration than in the Netherlands.
That's interesting.
Somehow, I feel more close to home here. I don't know why.
we didn't speak about it so directly, but maybe implicitly. I mean, indeed. Like QTech Delft is a very mission-driven place. So you have an entire group or institute that is very dedicated to fulfilling quite exact roadmaps and promises.
Mm-hmm.
So the research is, in a sense, less free and academic, and really more based on getting very specific results in a quicker time frame. Is that different in Düsseldorf, or how does it compare?
Yeah, so Düsseldorf is an academic environment. It's a university, TU Delft as well, but this came at the time. It was a bit of a surprise for me. I was not absolutely aware of where I was going. So it was very interesting because, I mean, in Delft, we would have, a Nobel Prize. The next day, the person was there giving a talk, or it was also like very fruitful. There was the different platforms of quantum technologies all together in the same building, even like this is something that it's not easy to see. But at the same time, then like all the works, so it was nice because I started, let's say, hardcore cryptography. It was in Delft, but there was really the worry that the work I'm doing, it has to be implementable.
Yeah.
And on my side, I really like to go more on this question. What could we do with quantum mechanics? And like not that necessarily to focus so much, how does it have to be implemented now? So there was no space for more so much abstract, even though like we do have quite some abstract works, but there was really a push for like, okay, the projects that can be implemented sometime soon. And then when I moved to Düsseldorf, I realized I was really missing just like going to a talk on cosmology or whatever, some other topic that is not so so important for my work right now, and enjoy more of the academic environment. So in Düsseldorf, there is, so actually, I mean, the cluster does have some specific goals, but it's not so much driven by industry as it was in Delft. So I think the cluster is very good balance, that there is like a push that, okay, we should do experiments as well. Or like I have collaborations with experimentalists, but it's not, let's say, cutting the creativity from other potential projects that can arise, and they still have space. So yeah, I think that's indeed a big difference of the two environments.
Yeah. I think that ML4Q, in that sense, it is a very broad collaboration, right?
Yes.
Much broader than QTech, in a sense, like in the number of topics that are being pursued, and therefore it can also afford to do more academic projects. And
the goal is to do more academic projects.
And indeed, you don't have industry partners on the same level, like mm-hmm. with, I think in Delft, the group of Stephanie Wehner was at some point collaborating with the Dutch telecommunications, like even with industrial partners, mm-hmm. or like,
yes,
telecommunication companies and
indeed.
So on. So, but yeah, let's talk a little bit about outreach. Like one of the things that you did was be a co-organizer on the Q-Turn conference, right?
Yes.
And how is, like, as a part of academic life, how is organizing a conference, like, not just, you know, arriving as a speaker or being a session chair, but really organizing?
It's quite stressful, and basically you don't really enjoy your own conference because you don't have the peace of mind to sit there and just watch the things, because there is things happening in the background. But in particular, the Q-Turn, I think it was also especially challenging because it's not a standard conference or well established. So for like a lot of our time was dedicated to discussing like things on the format or how we would handle. So there was this special care for like diversity and inclusion and how to do that. I'm saying I never got to organize one of the big conference, well-established conference, which I assume it's really also not few work. It's probably a lot of work, but you are in a structure where you don't have much freedom. And I suppose like, this has to be done, this has to be organized. And then you just figure out how to organize these particular things. While there, we had a lot of things. Do we want to add this? Do we want to add that? And on top of that, it was Corona time, so the conference was supposed to initially be in person, and it was already like advanced staged organization in India, and then we had to turn it online. So I think these two factors together made it extra challenging, the sense of let's say consuming much more of my time than it should have been once you commit to something like that.
But on the other hand, I mean, it's indeed an important community service. And I think the conference was more diverse than, let's say, APS March meeting or German DPG meeting, even already in the sense that it's more international, right? Like,
yes.
Most of the physics conferences they are the German Physics Conference or the American Physics Conference.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, people from everywhere come. But the...
Oh, I would say even compared to... I would hope that even compared to QIP, DQC, like the standard quantum information conferences that are international. Because we actively tried to reach more countries.
How much extra time did you, during the conference time, did you and the organizers spend on Zoom conferences out of the usual time of the conference?
Out of the usual, I don't know. I think at some point we had meetings once a week or so. And we were all from, actually, many of the people I worked with, I've never met until today. In the end, it turned out being online, let's say we also failed in diversity in the organization because the organization was mainly European, and ideally we would like to have the local organizers would have been much more involved if the conference would have happened locally. But yes, it was many, many hours on Zoom, I would say.
And what do you recommend the experience to other young researchers? Is it something? I mean, you do get to meet a lot of people, and I guess you learn a lot about how science organization works.
You mean organize a conference in general?
In general.
Yes, I mean, I do recommend, but for example, after Q-turn, I was like, okay, now I'm out of organizing for a few years because. Work did really accumulate, but I think it's important. Like, and once you do the organization, now I'm much more, let's say, soft on criticizing other conferences because I know which type of problems can happen. But I think I was going to comment on something that I find interesting that, we didn't had an edition of Q-turn, but I can see the impact, maybe not of Q-turn itself, but of these discussions that were happening in the community, that all the conferences nowadays, they have code of conduct. They have a team against harassment. I think these sometimes reached, and this is not so many years old that conference like QIP, TQC, they do have such things. So I see an impact of these discussions we were having. But for me then in the organization of Q-turn, it was also super interesting to participate on these discussions and being on the side that we had the power of making a decision and maybe really bringing some action to reality.
No, that's true. And I think especially in the physics community where, for example, the number of women is still at, like, let's say somewhere between 20% and 30% on average, probably. I think it's very good to have codes of conduct and so on, because it's for us, it's more easy to ignore, for example, problems of sexual harassment at conferences,
yeah,
because you have a majority of people where the likelihood of experiencing it is at least not as high.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really an important effort to change the community there. And I think that, the culture of, I don't know, just the boys going out together for beers at the conference and so on also can maybe improve in some places.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's really, really an important point. And then, yeah, we wanted to talk now about another outreach activity and the fact that you want to also do a podcast, but in Portuguese. So we have to talk about it. We get the chance to talk about it now in English, but we will have to wait for a newer version of AI to real-time translate it for us in a year or two.
Indeed.
So what's the podcast project that you're working on?
Yeah, so the idea is, it would be, let's say, a podcast to bring a bit of concepts of quantum mechanics to the general public. But at the same time, to make it more interesting, we are confronting pseudoscience, some misinformation, and so on. So the idea is always to bring up some sentences that you can hear in a non-scientific, pretending to be scientific context, and then bring up the discussion. So what quantum theory tells us about, what can we talk about? And so, yeah.
So yeah, if I hear this, I think about The Secret. I don't know if this book, right, where people say that if you want something strongly enough, you can turn it into reality, and it's somehow based on, I guess, entanglement or things like this.
Exactly.
So you are going to help clear up some of these misconceptions.
Actually, maybe I can tell something that we learned with the podcast. So I do this podcast together with my colleague Leonardo Ghirini. He's a mathematician and researcher in quantum information as well. And he went a lot through this literature, like Secret, Quantum Healing, and so on. And basically, at some point, he came to me and he said that he realized that there is the problem can be seen a bit as reductionism. That there is like the how is it called, the a bit like professionals pseudoscience, and there is the amateur pseudoscience, and the amateur pseudoscience is using reductionism in one direction, that is to say, like, look, photons, they electrons, they have these quantum properties, we are made of photons and electrons, therefore we have this quantum property. So reductionism in the up direction, mm-hmm. Let's say. And then that's why they claim all these claims. So this one is a bit more easy to contrapose. Mm-hmm. Because we can just say, look, the quantum properties don't last. They don't survive when you go to bigger systems.
Which we sadly see in quantum computation and quantum communication.
Exactly. So this is a bit more easy to confront. And basically all their claims are this extension of... But the professional ones...
Basically, you could say if your claims were right, then we would already have device independent...
Exactly. Yes, yes. Yeah. So, indeed. The other one is a reductionism in the other direction, as to say, but the physicists, they are reductionists because they want to explain the world with the laws of quantum mechanics, but we have consciousness, we have something we don't understand, and why this cannot explain this. So they go in the other direction. It was clear this. And these ones are very hard to, because there is not a statement that you can say, okay, this is obviously wrong because I have this other experiment. So these ones are really hard to, and usually they are professionals, and sometimes many of them are actually, they are physicists that then later went into this, but they have a physics background. So these are, I found quite interesting, and it's actually hard to find like clear statements that we can easily say, this is wrong because of that. Normally we just have to come with the authority argument, I just say, like, it's wrong, but or we can bring up some at the same time we can bring up but actually quantum theory tells us that, so this is more or less
I think
we are doing.
I think this is a really interesting point about quantum mechanics, because very early on in the history of quantum mechanics, people talked a lot about the observer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of the reasons why people now have this weird connection with consciousness and quantum mechanics was because for a long time people thought the observer needs to be a human, I guess.
Yeah.
And that somehow a human looking at something can change it. And then people were freaking out and coming up with all crazy, you know, like the fact that somebody looks at it changes it.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess in the more modern sense today, we would also see a qubit as an observer qubit and something that obviously does not have consciousness, right? So,
mm-hmm. Yes, but I mean, at the same time, I do find fascinating we don't understand consciousness. So this is a topic it's open. And
I mean, it's becoming more evident with ChatGPT, right? Because now people are really freaking out about it. And
even the definition. No.
You can talk to it and maybe it can say something like, I have consciousness or I don't have consciousness. And we really wouldn't know because we don't have any idea.
Yeah, so to me, in the sense, I find it natural that people go into this professional, let's say, pseudoscience. It's something that I see as, okay, reasonable that happens. What cannot happen is that then they make like very explicit claims and claim that this is quantum mechanics. So that is the point where we have to come and say, actually, so far, we have no evidence that quantum mechanics says these things.
Yeah, we should say in this podcast also very clearly, there's currently no good evidence for quantum healing. Please don't buy quantum healing from people on
books.
The internet.
Ah, yes, treatments also, yeah.
And yeah, it's a huge problem. And indeed, it's mostly, mostly the pseudoscience is trying to get the authority from quantum mechanics, a theory which we all love. And
yes, no, exactly. Because, I mean, you can speculate things, you can use analogies to inspire your religious beliefs or your... So any other fields, your artistic stuff. But the problem comes when people say, ah, but this is science. It's backed up by science. And then this is the moment. So you can come up with your theory of how to live life, your philosophy of life. This is not science. It's okay. But the problem is that they try to mask it in a shape that, it is backed up. There are studies and there are not. Yeah. But I find it interesting when I see people, they have very, they pick one of the interpretations and they are very convinced that this is a...
Yeah, it becomes a bit like a religion.
I do not have my religion yet.
No, I think also the beauty is that as long as you work with qubits or just with a finite-sized quantum system... I mean, we all agree on the mathematics, at least.
Yes.
And we don't have to pick.
Indeed.
Like, thank you a lot for the discussions and for looking a little bit at this more abstract perspective.
You're welcome.